The Kingmakers of Providence by John Hoole. Chapter 1, 4 years ago. I'm not burdened by personal conviction, Henry Mercutio admitted. With the top down and AC/DC blaring from the screen, cell phone pressed against his ear, he slid his black convertible up to the curb in front of a crowd of gawkers in their Sunday best. If you're telling me we gain 5 points, then Congressman McNally supports a $1,000 tax credit for working families. On the other end of the line was a pollster tracking the gubernatorial race. The sight of a political operative in a heated conversation was not unusual in the middle of an election season, but the mourner's glares told Henry he might be overdoing it. He pressed the button to redeploy the drop top and attempted to speak in lower tones. I know. He voted against it last session. But if it comes up now, we'll just say we're for it. Do you really think people remember what he voted for last year? And do you really think they care? That would mean they're actually paying attention to what's going on. And you and I both know the truth. As he stepped out of the car, he returned his phone to his suit jacket pocket. This was the last place he wanted to be 2 weeks before the election. A funeral in an Italian enclave of Providence, Rhode Island. A place where Machiavelli would have been at home, not only for the cuisine, but also for the city's approach to politics. In New England's second most important city, politics was a blood sport. It was not uncommon for nomination papers to mysteriously disappear from the Board of Elections, or for political yard signs to be defaced with profanities. The destruction of political enemies by any means necessary was as alive in 21st century Providence as it had been in 14th century Florence. But this was a somber time. One of the city's beloved political bosses had succumbed to a life of hard living. Antonio Campagna had been a heavyset man with a calm temperament and vivacious personality, who years of service to the people of his district had drawn more than 2,000 people to pay their respects. Senators, congressmen, councilmen, business leaders, carpenters, teachers, and firefighters all filed through the receiving line. Campana had worked 30 years in the Public Works Department as a laborer, a foreman, and eventually as its director, earning the admiration and respect of his community. But his evenings had been spent on the front lines of the local Democratic Party as a ward committee member and ultimately as an influential ward committee chairman. There was no election for political boss. It was something earned through respect, loyalty, and influence. He never had a problem delivering bodies for political events, since putting labels on mailers or making get-out-the-vote phone calls earned volunteers, Maria Campana's lasagna and stuffed shells. It was old-time politics, where loyalty was purchased through favors, but a man's word was ironclad. With the highest voter turnout of any area in the state, the district had always been a key opportunity for Democratic politicians to pay homage to the man who could guarantee a block of 15,000 votes. And those who challenge the natural order seal their political fates. When an ambitious political upstart refused to wait his turn and instead challenged a candidate in a primary supported by the Campanas, the young man not only lost the election, but also his city job, the very same one that had been procured for him in the first place. It was unwise to challenge the political reality in this part of town. With Campana's two sons serving as councilman and state representative, the family still retained its hold on the district, even now, after the patriarch's death. Congressman Ray McNally was from the old school, and he religiously made the election year pilgrimage to the Campana district. This time, however, he was honoring an old friend. At the moment, McNally was in the political battle of his life. Reasoning that it was better to be one of 50 governors than a member of Congress from the minority party of a minor state, he gambled his future as a tenured-for-life congressman for a chance of becoming the state's chief executive. The lifelong Democrat, the son of a carpenter who had risen to political stardom with the backing of the state's powerful union machine, was facing a formal challenge from the patrician Republican Attorney General, whose family represented some of the state's oldest money. With the family name and unlimited war chest, Jeremiah J. Whitfield was on his way to purchasing the election and maintaining the Republicans' national majority of governors. Leading Congressman McNally's campaign was Henry Mercutio, a 30-year-old graduate of Boston College and Georgetown Law School who had traded a promising law career for his passionate first love, politics. He'd caught the political bug while in college, interning during a hotly contested senatorial campaign. After taking a year off to work for the president's reelection, He'd met the congressman, then the president's regional campaign chairman. Throughout law school and during his first years as a young lawyer in Washington, D.C., Harry remained close to Congressman McNally as his political advisor. He had counseled him to wait for an open Senate seat, but the governor's office was a post McNally had always coveted. Even though he disregarded Henry's advice, the congressman had ultimately tapped him to run his campaign. Harry now found himself 7 points down with 2 weeks to close the gap. That was the only thing on his mind as he walked through the brass doors of St. Bartholomew's Church. He needed McNally to focus on the last televised debate, where he hoped to use debate footage and a series of television ads to contrast his candidate's knowledge and experience with his opponent's inexperience and ineptitude. Standing stoically in the church, he began calculating in his head the general voter turnout along with the union numbers and the political base needed to deliver victory. Like any true believer in politics, Henry held on to the hope that his candidate could still win, even though the polls predicted defeat. He argued that the polling numbers were unreliable, since they did not factor in McNally's enthusiastic union support. If union members and their households came out in droves as promised, Henry rationalized that McNally could close the growing gap with his Republican opponent. Amid the grievers, however, only Henry was preoccupied with the election. Congressman McNally, standing with one of the bereaved sons, motioned to him. Henry dreaded the congressman's introductions, which reminded him of his father's insistence that he kiss one of his old aunts. "Henry, come over and say hello to Councilman John Campana." Henry said the things expected in those situations. "I'm very sorry for your loss. Your father was very well respected. Thank you for coming, Mr. Mercutio." Councilman Campana appeared unimpressive, short and overweight with a receding hairline, but he carried himself with the grace of a man aware of his power. Unlike many other politicians who felt the need to remind their followers how important they were, Campana did not need to project his power. Humility governed him, but when challenged, he emulated the tiger. Asked the fellow councilman, who had broken ranks with leadership and had voted against the council's budget at the request of the mayor, in the next election, Campana had recruited and financed the councilman's successor, defeating him by a wide margin. Campana did not crave war, but when attacked, especially when it involved his selfless plans for his city, he showed little restraint taking out his enemies. After obliging the congressman, Henry approached him with a careful eye trained on the people he was greeting, ready to move him along to the next potential voter. He motioned the congressman toward the door, but the congressman brushed off his gesture. After a few more minutes of Henry's silent entreaties, McNally turned to him with an uncomprising look. "You're supposed to be at the senior center in half an hour," Henry told him. "Forget the seniors. I'm going to John Campana's house," he said. "Call Carrie and tell her to reschedule the senior center." "You can't," Henry whispered. "They're expecting you. We've got coffee and a vanload of ice cream. They're a vote we need." McNally put his hand on Henry's shoulder. "Listen, I don't expect you to understand. I owe it to the Campanas. It would be disrespectful if I didn't go to John's house." As his boss turned to greet another supporter, Henry faded back into the crowd of mourners. Never before had he seen so many people in a church. In fact, St. Bartholomew's had to open its basement to accommodate the overwhelming turnout, who had to watch the funeral on a closed-caption TV provided by a local electronics store. No longer was it about honoring a life well-lived. Antonio Campana's funeral had become a showcase for the who's who of Providence political and social elite. The funeral procession was so grand that 4 additional stretch limousines had been ordered to accompany the hearse and 2 family cars. The mayor and city council, along with the leadership of the state Senate and state House of Representatives, had each commandeered their own limousines. This had forced the governor to add his own black Suburban to the caravan and the other general officers of the state to follow suit with their vehicles. The city and state police had no choice but to shut down city streets and 5 miles of highway along the interstate to accommodate the convoy. They had all come to honor a man who had dedicated his life to public service, who had taken care of the people who needed a helping hand in life. There was plenty of proof of that in the crowd. Walking down the aisle was the widow who had recouped her husband's survivor benefits after Campana had talked to the union bosses. At a pew near the casket was a young man whom he had helped find a city job. And there was a United States congressman who had never forgotten that the first endorsement he had won in his first race for the state Senate had been from Campana's ward committee. But there was also the city councilman, hoping to win support for the council presidency. Hovering near the door was the attorney general, who did not want to concede Campana's base to McNally. And of course, never to miss a political event, was Mayor Jack Donovan. Though he had battled Councilman Campana over the budgets and city contracts, he would not miss an opportunity to touch the flesh of nearly 700 potential voters. He made his grand entrance with little regard for protocol or ceremony, forcing the bishop to delay mass so the mayor could meet and greet his flock. The hypocrisy and self-serving behavior of the politicians faking their remorse betrayed the ideals of public service that Campana had embodied. This cruel sense of irony struck Henry. He had graduated from college and law school with youthful idealism, but after this emotional roller coaster and the lessons it had imparted, he was uncertain he wanted to ride again. The tumultuous campaign had broken Henry's altruistic spirit. The unscrupulous tactics and arbitrary morality had forced him to question his role in a system that seemed to care more about maintaining power than representing the people's will. As a political consultant, Henry understood that campaigns were not unlike high school elections. The most popular kid always won, not the person who put forth the best ideas. Henry was nostalgic for the politics of Antonio Campana's time, a kinder era, epitomized by what a politician could deliver to his community, not but what he could take for himself. He knew what had changed politics. It had been in his hands only 2 hours before the funeral, a $100,000 check to the television station for commercial time. The injection of money into the system had created a dependency. Without cash from wealthy donors, corporations, and unions alike, campaign staffs could not be hired, professional ads could not be broadcast, and victory could not be attained. Today's politicians had traded walking door to door and hearing the problems and issues of their neighbor for neatly packaged sound bites and carefully crafted 30-second clips. Gone were the days of neighborhood rallies and volunteer-packed halls, only to be replaced by high-end fundraisers and professional phone banks. It was the cold, unattached politics of the present Henry didn't like. Politics had become a business, one in which he no longer wanted to ply his trade. A breed of disciples who aggressively pursued their own self-interest was the byproduct of this form of public service. No longer regarded as Plato's highest calling, but instead Machiavelli's means to an end. Henry expected to have to duel with this new strain of young politicos from the opposition campaign, but he never expected that his greatest challenge would come from within his own campaign. Gordon Biko, Congressman McNally's district director, had been passed over as campaign manager in the gubernatorial bid and had used this self-perceived betrayal by McNally to punish the campaign. His principal target was Henry, and taking down McNally's golden boy had become his obsession. The truth only suited Biko when it matched his objectives. Lies were spun, intended to undermine Henry's authority, even though a ploy he devised had cost him the support of the Providence Teachers Union. Biko felt little remorse in sabotaging the campaign. He told the union president that McNally, under Henry's advice, planned to cross a picket line in front of a fundraiser in Providence for a prominent United States senator, an early favorite to be president. The mayor, an independent who did not have a particular problem jibbing his sails with prevailing winds, planned to attend the Democratic fundraiser. The teachers' union, which had engaged in a prolonged contract battle with Mayor Donovan, sought to embarrass him in front of the state and national media by picketing the event and forcing politicians to perform their own version of a perp walk. That was what bothered Henry the most. There was no honor in this game. People changed their positions, even their convictions and personalities, to suit whatever served them at the moment. The naive belief that he could effectuate change had attracted him to this business. The excitement of being part of something bigger than himself had enthralled him. He had spent his entire adult life in the political trenches. In college, while other students were at frat parties, he had been working spaghetti dinners with the local city council. When his law school classmates were jockeying for internships and jobs, he was writing speeches and position papers for Congressman McNally. Now, instead of practicing law and earning more than six figures, he was running a political campaign for a man whose positions were determined by what bought the most votes. And although he had fallen in love with a woman he had searched his whole life for, he spent more of his time with politicians than with her. Henry desperately needed to get out of this game before he was entirely lost.